Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Sarcini.
I'm Dwayne DeFreitas.
And I'm Chris Brunor.
Tosin Onofuaken should be joining us a little bit later. He's en route. This week, the NSA is eavesdropping on our phone calls, emails, texts, and all online activity in the name of national security. Are we overreacting or not acting enough? Also, the NSA may have our data, but they can never patent our DNA. Microsoft does a 180 on their follow-up to the 360, and Google creates a network of floating balloons. As always, you can check out the past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes by going to geeksofdoom.com, and our subscription link is in the right-hand sidebar. And join us on Facebook and Twitter at The Drill Down. And tonight we have a special guest with us, Greg Davies. Now, Greg is a fellow podcaster. He used to run a podcast called Social Blend and would occasionally be a guest on The Drill Down in the past. Greg, how you doing?
I'm fantastic. How you doing, Andy? Guys, nice to meet you. It's an absolute pleasure to be back on The Drill Down.
Tell us a little bit about yourself and what you're doing now. Like, what podcasts?
Yeah, it's been a while. Well, The Drill Down, of course, is hosted at geeksofdoom.com, which is where I also post. I do a lot of reviews and writing over there. And some of the other podcast listeners will know me also from the TARDIS blend there at geeksofdoom.com, which is where we, Tom Teradar and myself, talk up a lot of stuff about Doctor Who and who...
That is a fantastic podcast, by the way.
Dude, we have a great time doing it. It's going to be interesting coming up to the 50th anniversary in November. We're going to get a lot of plans, and we've also got some bets and wagers on the table as to what's going to happen, so that'll be cool.
My girlfriend and I are planning to go to Wales for the 50th anniversary.
Oh, really? That's fantastic.
Yeah. Nice.
Sorry to interrupt. So I also co-host a podcast called Blendover, which was born out of Social Blend, hence the moniker. Which is also a double entendre in case you didn't catch it. It's at blendover.com, and we do a weekly podcast there. It's me and Terry Trevera, and we basically do a bit of a teardown of the stories that the media isn't really covering, or aspects of the stories that they're looking at that they're not covering, and also stuff that's kind of being overlooked by some of the major podcasts around there. So we kind of like... grab the stuff that's flying under the radar a little bit and stuff like that. So as an example, in the most recent episode, we did a huge deconstruction about what's going on in Nigeria at the moment, which is going to be huge news over the next few years as all of the military powers that be look at that area. So, but of course, one of the major focuses we've been doing recently has been PRISM, which is a huge deal, and I know we're going to be talking about that tonight on The Drill Down here. So I'm looking forward to getting down in deep and dirty into some of that that mess.
Before we get into the headlines, we occasionally like to do a segment of the show we call What We're Playing With, where we talk about the gadgets, apps, and tech that has obsessed us over the last week. And Dwayne, you wanted to tell us about something that you got within the last couple of weeks, right?
Yeah, I picked up the Ouya about a week and a half ago, which is surprising to me because I never filled out like a survey about where I live, so I had to like email them and say, hey guys, by the way, I got an Ouya, can you please send me whatever? but I got it. I got the two controllers, and I had one special HDMI port just set up and waiting for it, and I popped it in.
Let's backtrack just a second now. So for the people that don't know, the Ouya is the Android-powered game console that started off as a Kickstarter project.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So I backed the Ouya, the idea being that just like an iOS device or an Android device, here's a system that allows you to download games off the internet. It's playing on mobile hardware, which, you know, could get dated, but the idea is because it's a console, the software that's available for Android will be written for this. There'll be an Ouya version of this software because you're clearly dealing with it via controllers instead of touch. So it's a developer friendly platform. It ties to Google Play, that kind of thing. And I gotta say that I've downloaded a couple games.
Mm-hmm.
A couple were underwhelming, but a couple were really fun. And I guess I downloaded a few games then. And I've had a bunch of fun with it. I haven't actually done a multiplayer thing yet because my girlfriend's like, I don't care. And I've had a friend over to mess around with it. But the controller, the quality of the device, let me just start say it's fantastic.
Sure.
Uh-huh. It's a device you can cup in your hand. It's about the size of a like teacup, right?
Sure.
So
a clenched like a fist teacup. Is I think how I described it.
Yeah, or I described it before. Yeah. It's about the size of a teacup. It has like the functionality is great. You plug it in, it lets you prompts you through everything. I had a little trouble getting it onto my N network, so it's on my G network, but I don't think it really matters so much. And
it's a little bit surprising. I mean, N has been around forever.
I know. I think I've definitely had problems with my N network to begin with. I have a feeling that I'll be getting like a beamform based device in a little while, but. I hooked it up, I got it, and I got online, and the graphics on my, I have a 1080p TV, the graphics are, like, fine, they're good, they're sitting up there with, they're definitely better than the Wii, first of all, and it's way smaller. It's nice to have a device that is not going to mess around with your configuration of your home entertainment system.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I have that thing hanging out behind one of my small tweeter speakers, because it's that tiny. And because the controllers are Bluetooth, you don't need a line of sight to run to it. I was a little worried about that. I knew that there was supposed to be Bluetooth, but you never know what the quality that's going to be, especially when the device is hanging out behind a magnetically controlled speaker. But it works fine. I have no issues. It comes with batteries included for mm-hmm. your controllers. That's huge. And although I used my own rechargeable. And the controller quality is fantastic. I mean, I play with an Xbox controller or a PSD controller,
mm-hmm.
and then I touch this Ouya controller. You know, it's got the two analog buttons. It's got the analog controls. It's got the four little buttons. It's got the D-pad, and the grip, the feel, the upper right left, the lower right left. All these things are reminiscent of a high quality console. The batteries are built. You can actually take off the top and pop the batteries in one by one. It's just a really well-designed, good-feeling thing in your hand.
You forgot to mention the other feature about the controller. The other input.
I don't know. Go ahead.
It's got a touchpad input between the two control, like standard controls.
D-pads, yeah, the right and left?
No, not D-pad. Up above. Maybe you weren't even aware of this.
I was not even aware of this. No, please help me out. Help me out, Andy. Tell me about my.
It's
Ouya.
Right in the middle, right above the button where you push the U to connect it to the system. Right above mm-hmm. there, that whole blank sort of flat black area is a touchpad interface.
That's why it's so blank.
Yes,
I was wondering. Andy, Ouya. No, it's a great device. Like, I gotta say, like, the quality of the device is high. I don't know how long the whole, like, you can take off the face and put it back on in order to get your batteries in and out is gonna be is gonna last. But right now, I feel like as long as you treat it well, you'll be in good shape. And I'm pretty pleased with the gameplay. I played, I forgot the names of the game, but I played, like, a kind of space pod racer kind of game thing. Which is pretty fun, and I played a top-down kind of Zelda type thing. That's pretty fun. I haven't had any negative experiences with it so far. It just took me a little while to get it on the network, and we need that. And you know, it's got a significant amount of storage. Still, one of these games that are like 100 megabytes that look good are not a big problem.
Yeah.
And really, for me, I don't like the disc aspect of a lot of the consoles. So for me, that was a big thing. I'm surprised
this is the future, isn't it? Really, when you think about it, this is they're already on to the next generation.
Yeah,
right. Exactly. So I really feel like that's the thing. I don't even like discs when it comes to my media. I've converted every single DVD I have to like an M4V or an MP4 and put it on my Mac. So it's one of those things. So I really enjoy the fact that it's kind of like I get on, I use the controller. It's pretty intuitive. And it's an exciting device. I'm not going to say that the Ouya is a must-have device. I think it's got some things to prove. I'm not going to say that you want to buy a device that's like a little more, it's like, you know, a year and 3 months in the making when it's running Android hardware, because Android hardware has improved. But I am going to say this concept is fantastic. And if this is the way that games are moving, I'm going to become a gamer again in a way that I haven't been for some time, because the computer paradigm was where I wanted it. And the console paradigm was lacking because of the physical discs and because of the lack of because of the size of those boxes and having to sit in front of my computer and everything. You know, I plugged the Ouya into my monitor in front of my computer and just messed with it, and it's been great.
What's the game sort of like, who makes the games? Is it all first party games now, or have they gotten some third party?
Oh no, they're third party developers. You put your credit card in pretty much. They're very upfront when you set it up. What's your credit card number? And you put that in, and you're like, okay, I'll see what happens. And the games are on par with iOS and Android-style games. You're paying like $1, maybe $3, maybe $6 for a game. And you're getting it from independent developers that are on the Ouya store. And it works really well. And these developers, they are coding these because they've coded them for Android games already, you know? It's good.
I have to say that I also received my Ouya, I think the same day that you did, but later on in the day. And one of the things I noticed is it's incredibly light. And that's even with iFixit did a teardown of this device, and they've discovered that most of the weight of the device came from weights that have been placed at the bottom of the device to weigh it down so that the cables...
To make us tech geeks feel as if it's got that level of quality.
Well, it also make it sit better. Yeah, so it sits... Apple TVs have that problem where they're so light that the cord pulls it up.
Yeah, exactly. But otherwise, it's super, super light. It's a tiny little Android board. And I will tell you the secret... the secret games that I've found to be like the killer apps for Ouya. It's not any of the third party games that Android developers have made for the Ouya. It's the emulators for the SNES and the Nintendo 64 and the Atari 2600. There's a number of emulators for other systems.
You have my attention. You said N64 there. Please continue.
Yes.
Are you telling me that I can play Mario Kart on my Ouya?
Yes. Yes. With ROMs that are available online. You know, you have
and
to get...
How difficult is it to get these on my Ouya, given that they're not on the store?
All you have to do is transfer the ROMs to a thumb drive, and then plug the thumb drive into the back of your Ouya, and then navigate to the file location where the thumb drive is on through the individual apps, through the emulator apps.
So you're saying they've made an out of the box Dreamcast with side loading apps. That's what you're saying.
Yes. Yes.
That's pretty fantastic, because that saves me from having to go and get those old consoles. I was about to do it.
Yep.
I'd love a PS2. I'd love a PS2 emulator.
I think that's asking a little too much out of the Ouya, but yeah, it would be nice.
Well, maybe Ouya 2 will be able to handle PS2 games, because that Resident Evil 4, whatever it was, is fantastic.
All right, so we've got like three headlines that I feel are important enough to cover this week before we get into our NSA Prism discussion. And as long as we're talking video games... Microsoft has taken an enormous amount of heat regarding DRM policies with its new console. Sony became consumer heroes at E3, announcing PlayStation 4 would not treat used games differently and the status quo would reign. Well, today, a week after Sony was declared the, quote, winner of E3, Microsoft announced in a press release the following changes to the Xbox One. First of all, an internet connection will not be required to play offline Xbox One games. After a one-time system setup with a new Xbox One, you can play any disc-based games without ever connecting online again. There's no 24-hour connection requirement, and you can take your Xbox One anywhere you want and play your games, just like on your Xbox 360. And also, trade-in, lend, resell, gift, and rent disc-based games just like you do today. There'll be no limitations to using and sharing games. It'll work just as it does today on the Xbox 360. So, obviously, Sony's... success at E3 made them do a turnabout on their policies.
don't think it's just that, though, Andy. I think it's also because of the reaction they got from the core gaming audience. I mean, ever since the announcement that they made pre-E3, where it was all about TV, 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 sports, and a dog in Call of Duty, you know, the reaction from gamers should have been an indication at that point before E3 that they were on the wrong track. And they're backtracking this, so they well should. So they should. And shame on them.
Name into that. This is a feat of like user input, but it's also buttressed by old school competition. Sony kept their mouth shut and they waited, and that was a good thing. But Microsoft made some serious janky moves, as Greg points out. Like, you don't tell people that they're going to spend $60 on a game and that that game is not going to be one that they can then push forward. And then economically speaking, let's face it, over the last generation, if I spend $60 a game today and 3 weeks later after I beat it, I sold it for $30, took that $30 and put it toward buying a new game for $60, you're making money, Microsoft. So this was a stupid move. Absolutely stupid move.
So, in the light of this new update, would you consider buying an Xbox One instead of a PS4?
You know, they still have like the other things that we talked about though in their favor. I mean, the PS3 is still, or the PS4 is still better hardware and cheaper.
Yeah, I think the PS4 is a smaller footprint. I'm not trying to connect my console to my cable box, which I stopped owning. I get all my stuff through iTunes and Netflix and so on and so forth. And frankly, I don't know how you guys feel, but for the first time, I actually trust Sony more than I trust Microsoft, and that's a big deal to me.
That's a huge deal, considering some of the flubs that they've done in the last couple of years. Yeah. And, you know, with the data loss and right, all of that stuff and being hacked and everything, that was a huge deal, and that was a big strike against consumer confidence against Sony. And so, I mean, that speaks volumes right there.
Not to mention that last night they just issued a update for the PlayStation 3 that bricked some of the systems.
I
sort of expect that sort of thing out of them. I mean, between, I can't even say which of them is better than that. There's the Three Rings of Death on the Xbox, and they lost, you know, in terms of just, yeah.
Yeah, everyone remembers the Three Rings of Death, but everyone seems to forget, like, how much crap that Sony used to get when they put the PS3 out at such a high price. You know, it was getting lots of criticism. I mean, this is back.
But they've learned a little bit. I mean, the PS3 is still coming out at $100 less than the Xbox, right?
Yeah.
So that's a big deal. But I see what you're saying, Greg. The PS3 came out, and it was definitely, from an American perspective, not the hot shit compared to Microsoft's, like, I'm going to take a loss in the hardware for you, my people, kind of thing.
All right, let's move on here. Mobile data might seem near ubiquitous, but the world still has major dead zones and huge expanses with poor coverage. Over the weekend, Google launched Project Loon, an initiative to help fill in those internet gaps through the use of network balloons. The goal is to provide broadband-like internet for the two-thirds of the world that doesn't have access to a reliable internet connection. To do this, Google uses a network of actual high-altitude balloons that fly in the sky above the Earth. The launch of the project consisted of launching 30 balloons, each of which are capable of providing internet access with speeds comparable to 3G. The balloons were launched over New Zealand as a testbed and fly about 12 miles high, each of which is able to provide an internet connectivity for an estimated hundreds of people within a 25-mile diameter. The Loon balloons are networked to each other with a radio transceiver and are also in contact with the ground thanks to another. Each balloon has a third transceiver for backup purposes, is tracked with onboard GPS, is powered via solar panels, which takes about 4 hours for a full charge, and the extra energy is stored in a rechargeable battery.
Yeah, I was going to say, the power is the thing I would be most concerned about with a situation like that.
Well, when you're that high up, and you know, I live a mile high, the sun is ridiculous. So at 12 miles, I think you're in really good shape for getting some solar power.
Yeah. It's up to 20 miles, actually. I was reading some of the stuff before. Andy, it's interesting about this because now essentially what you're saying is the net is in the sky.
Oh, wow, that's so scary.
So Google has launched a sky net, is what you're saying.
Exactly.
Google would be the company to do that.
Oh, if only Lydia were here.
It's also interesting that Chris and Dwayne don't really know me that well, but Andy knows that I'm the kind of person that, like, I like to sit on the fence to hear all kinds of points of view. So, like, I'll listen to, like, the rational official story on one side, but I also like to listen to, you know, the tinfoil hat crackpot
yes.
stories as well. And I try and listen to both of them, and then I make up my own mind about what's potentially going on here. And I'm really surprised that none of the crackpots have jumped on this yet and said that there's some kind of connection between this and, say, the CIA or military intelligence, because you know these intelligence agencies are dying to chuck cameras on these things.
But you also know that Google doesn't do any EPO.
Oh yeah, sure.
I think this is interesting because, I mean, Google is such an inventive company. The way Google solves problems, it from an engineering geek perspective, is sort of the way Apple solves problems from a consumer perspective. Like, of course that's how it would work, right? If you think about this issue, it's kind of like, wait a minute. So you're telling me you can give me internet connection from a balloon in the sky? Yeah. Why haven't we done that before? Is it weird? Is it strange? Is it reliable? Who knows? But we're crackpot enough to give it a shot, right? Yeah. Like, that's the whole point. Yeah. And that's where I feel comfortable with Google. I feel excited about Google. I feel excited about that level of ingenuity coming out of this country. I'm just sad for Greg that it's going to New Zealand before it's going to Australia.
It'll end up there. But you know what's really interesting about this is that it makes me wonder if Google has or are about to develop a time travel machine, because I don't know if you've seen photos of these balloons, but they look awfully a lot like the debris that was found in Roswell in 1947. Right. It's very different stuff. And part of me wonders, like, if it got sent back in, like, some kind of time tunnel and it crashed in 1947, kind of explaining that.
Nah, they're not into Roswell. They're into Star Trek. They've proven that.
Oh, okay.
That's right. That's why we've discussed that.
You know, this isn't actually as crazy of an idea as it sounds. A lot of third world internet providers essentially do the same thing, except without with balloons. They're doing it with, like, towers. But if you're out, like when I was doing my NGO work in Sierra Leone, like, we got all of our internet from a tower that was, you know, powered by a single generator, and they got its data connection from another tower like 20 miles away that basically hopped until it eventually got to a main line. And that's, like, the primary way that people, you know, out in the bush, you know, get.
Or in New Zealand.
Which I guess is now the bush too, you know, get internet. And it's really amazing how effective it's been that, like, you know, I was out in a place where we didn't have clean drinking water, we didn't have power, but we had internet. And so I think improving that and getting even more internet and faster internet is just brilliant.
Yep.
That's interesting, because I kind of feel like it's kind of strange, because what's more stable? If you're in an unstable environment like Sierra Leone, which has had civil wars, is a tower that's in the ground more stable than a balloon that's in the sky? It's interesting to hear which is what, because I feel like
there's nothing they can do about a balloon 12 to 25 miles up in the sky, and it's
right. Exactly. Right. I feel like a balloon 12, 20 miles up in the sky, I guess it might be tethered, it may not be, who knows, it may be on a little motor, who knows. But what's interesting to me is that if you're going to have a truly unstable situation, like, you know, like one of these Arab Spring things, you're going to be able to take better advantage of this situation with the balloon, rather than what you'd normally get with the tower. So it's kind of interesting that they've started in New Zealand. I guess New Zealand is remote enough, but it's Western enough and stable enough to, like, give it a shot. But this is going to be really powerful.
Just because they're starting in New Zealand doesn't mean it's just going to be in New Zealand. See, the whole premise of the project is that, you know, and it's really interesting, and that is the winds that are at that level, you know, 20 miles above the Earth, are consistent, and you can actually, like, steer or sail effectively your balloons into those winds, and they will go circulate the Earth, basically, and then you can steer them to the next wind flow that will take them back along the track. So, yeah, these balloons will be circulating over New Zealand for a little while, but, you know, eventually what they're going to be doing for further testing will be using that as a base point that will be circulating pretty much the southern hemisphere. So it'll be really interesting to see how it pans out. But I can guarantee you that, you know, that these guys are going to be putting cameras on these things, and Google Maps is going to be like Google Earth and all that. It's going to be like of a quality that you've never before experienced.
Which is surprising, considering what they've been able to lay out recently in I.O. with the Google Maps and how detailed that was. So, I mean, they've been looking for these remote spaces. They've been sending – well, not sending. They've been supporting their high-end Google Maps developers and photographers when they go out on big mission, when they go out on their own vacations to Everest and so on and so forth. This is going to allow us to really monitor things like the rainforest, monitor things like – and I'm talking like, you know, where I'm from in Guyana or like in you know, the Congo or wherever. And that's exciting. It's exciting to be able to like explore our world that way. Especially because like these 3G connections are completely going to be used to send data back. So almost more than they're going to be used to allow people to get access to data.
And Dwayne, you touched upon something a little earlier that I thought might be really revolutionary, is that these balloons, once they're in areas that are high enough and over countries that are that have a sketchy stability as nations, these could actually act as conduits to, essentially conduits to internet freedom that the people in that area have not had access to before.
That'll be interesting. I want to see Anonymous hack these things. That's what I want to see.
Wasn't Anonymous planning on doing this, or was it Pirate Bay that was planning on doing Arduinos or Raspberry Pis throughout Europe? I know one of them was.
The more we get communication, the more problems get solved, right? Like, the more people can – the more you can understand the sentiment of people. And this is one of the things where, like, we've talked about, you know, Google and how it, like, you know, Yahoo had maps. It has better maps. Apple had a phone. Google chased that down. You know, Yahoo, Bing, I mean, Microsoft, all these guys had search. Google obviously beat that. Hyper-competitive company, company that likes to look at what you have and go after it and make it better. You know, Microsoft has Docs and Office, and they do that. This is one of those things, like the car, like Glass, where they're really branching out in a new way with a new type of product and a new type of service. And this is where, for me, Google shines. This is where, you know, for me, I want to buy yet more Google stock. This is where, for me, I want to look at them and I see them as the you know, the light bringer, right? Prometheus.
This kind of stuff also backfires on them too. I mean, you know, Google are by no means a perfect company as well, and I think that's the biggest thing about Google that I appreciate more, is that they have no shame in failing. You know, and there's certain products like web products, as an example. You know, like Google, what was it? Google Wave,
right?
And Buzz and all that stuff. That just
Wave was a fantastic product, by the way.
Idea. It was a great idea, but just it was wrong place, wrong time. I think yeah. if they brought that back now and integrated it into Google Plus, they'd be on a winning deal there.
Yeah, there's that. I mean, Wave technology was recycled into Docs and a whole bunch and Gmail and a whole bunch of other things. You're right. It was ahead of its time. Much like Glass may be ahead of its time. People do not seem ready to adopt Glass as a standard means of regular mobile technology. But yeah, they're not afraid to fail, and they're used to having shit in beta forever. But that's what's great about them. This is a new way of looking at the world, literally, like how
Can I actually bring up while we're talking about Google, just slightly different topic? I think because I'm going to be on this episode and I'm not going to be around for the episode where this time comes up. But just a reminder: the 1st of July, we should all bow our heads in mourning for the Google Reader.
Oh, I would, except for the fact that I've been using the iOS Reader app for the last 3 years, and I absolutely adore it, and I'm cool.
Also, both Feedly and Digg have rolled out readers that they both hope to fulfill the empty gap that Google Reader is going to leave.
And if you use Microsoft Office and you have Microsoft Office Outlook, there's an RSS reader built in that will deliver the content from the feeds you specify into your inbox if you wanted to, or into like a separate reader feed.
It's also but the craft RSS design ever made. Just saying, it's terrible.
It's not the best, smoothest situation, but I'm saying that for people, I mean, it's such a ubiquitous program, Outlook, that if you do like to get your news in an app instead of, you know, on the web, there's a way to do it there. Like, obviously, Google Reader going down, highly problematic, you jerks.
Yes.
You don't control all of readers, or you don't control RSS and then shut it down because you want people to use Google Plus. Not cool.
Which doesn't even do RSS.
No. Right. They're replacing it with what is it? Google on the Android. It's Google. What is it? Cards or what is it called?
Now, Google, I don't know.
That's what the replacement thing is.
Well, you know why they shut it down was they actually did the research and they discovered that RSS is effectively dead. Like, there's a small subset of people who are using RSS nowadays.
But it doesn't cost a lot to keep that up and running. Like, I guess, like, there's some computers that keep it up and running. It's probably got, like, 200 servers somewhere, and that's an electricity cost. But it's not like, that bad. I mean, what is it doing? It's taking shit that you asked for, and it's putting it in a thing, and when you read it, it calls it. It's not a huge burden based on the rest of the stuff they have, and it's not, I don't know, it's not in an end-of-life space. Like, it's just not there. So well, the fact that these other apps have shown up and these people are able to use them and leverage them, like Reeder for iOS or the dig situation or Feedly. I mean, RSS is real. RSS is more powerful. I think it's you know, Twitter has obviously taken a big chunk out of RSS's thunder. But at the same time, this is a – go ahead.
I'm sorry. What was the RSS tool that you're using on iOS?
It's called Reeder, Reeder.
Okay, I'll check it out.
It's quite.
I haven't tried it before.
I like the old Reader. I absolutely love the old Reader. I was using it a little. Had recently switched to it just before the switchover, and it's basically like Google Reader, like used to be, like just very simple, straight up. So I actually much prefer that to Feedly, which I've never really liked. So I don't know. In some ways, Google Reader shutting down is actually like almost sort of reinvigorated this market. I mean, there's so many like new takes on RSS technology and the ways to do it that I don't know, maybe in some ways it's almost a good thing, as much as I hate them for it.
Yeah.
I don't know. I just don't like the fact that they took over the market and shut it down. This is like this idea that, you know, you have like a big discount store come in, like a Walmart, and it shuts down all the mom and pop stores, and then it begins raising its prices slightly. Like, did Walmart do that? There's no consensus about it, but you know that it's taking out competition, and well, you know, at the same time, it could be like mass marketing something. It takes out competition, and then when they decide that they're unilaterally going to stop supporting that, it is problematic from the perspective of people who are fans. But this also goes to show why it's important that if there's a service you like, you be given the means and ability to support it financially, because that way it'll do what it can to stay alive. And I think that's like the iOS Reader. It's free on iPhone, and it's like $4 or $5 on iPad. And I bought it because I know that I wanted to you know, I could probably live without it on my iPad, but I bought it because I wanted to support it, because I know that if I support it, it's less likely that it'll go away with an arbitrary motion from that like organization. And that's one of those things. So I don't know. I think that it's a yucky move. I get the business sense behind it, but I'm a fan, and because I'm a fan, I'm not going to look at it rationally and through a business sense.
And fair enough, as you shouldn't. All right, last headline here. Supreme Court ruled Thursday that human genes cannot be patented, a decision with both immediate benefits for some breast and ovarian cancer patients and long-lasting repercussions for biotechnology research. The decision represents a victory for cancer patients, researchers, and geneticists who claim that a single company's patent raised costs, restricted research, and sometimes forced women to have breasts or ovaries removed without sufficient facts or second opinions. Since 1984, the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office has granted more than 40,000 patents tied to genetic material. About one-fourth of the 22,000 human genes have been patented, patents that are now invalidated. That could open up competition in genetic testing for diseases ranging from Duchenne muscular dystrophy to inheritable heart arrhythmia. I'm very happy about this because it seems to make common sense that you can't patent someone's DNA, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was always a little strange. It was always a little weird that, like, the patent law specifically says that you cannot patent something that occurs in nature. And while I'm sure it's highly difficult to understand exactly what genes do what, I mean, we had a whole human genome project in order to figure out some of that stuff out. The idea that a human gene that exists already in nature can be patented and then access to it and the research associated with it and the healthcare associated with it is now private and for license only doesn't make a lot of sense from a pure logic perspective. Now, the law always has nuance, and the law is about the law, not what's right. But I'm glad that what's right coincides with the law in this case.
Yeah, and I feel like this is a good precedent to set this early on moving forward, because I could see where it would be a real issue further on as we start to develop gene therapies based on DNA. And if those DNA, if that DNA had remained patented, it would just, the skyrocketing costs of paying those patent licenses would have prohibited the necessary technology that would facilitate important breakthroughs in biology.
Yeah,
it's just messy. Like, obviously, the private industry is going to be like, well, I have no incentive now to go and figure out what I can do with genes. And that's okay, because I have a feeling that the universities are going to be able to figure some of that stuff out. And the fact is, we can't put a price on everything. The code that makes us who we are, that doesn't need a price.
Yeah.
When you figure out a new gene, some shit you can put in like a veteran who's missing a hand, like some frog shit mixed with some human shit to regrow the hand, yes. Patent the fuck out of that. But up until then, when the shit just happens, like I have five toes because my shit was written to have five toes, and one of them is really big, don't patent that. Patent the new shit. When you can give like, you know, when you can do it so that you can screw with a person and make him grow a prehensile tail and have that shit for your super soldier shit, yeah, go ahead, patent that shit. Get a government contract and make some tail fucking super soldiers hanging off trees in Africa. Who cares? But when it comes to, you know, the normal everyday, like your run-of-the-mill human being, yeah, let's keep that open source for now, right?
I'm interested. Humans are open source.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
Not Google open source, real open source, like Firefox. Like a little clunky, not always the best thing around. You could probably get something better, but that is not like as locked down as Android can be. You know what I mean? But we certainly don't need Apple style code in that jammy.
I'm interested in knowing. I know the article that we're specifically looking at here. It refers directly to human genes.
Yeah.
But I'm really interested in actually looking at the Supreme Court documentation on that and see if it does specify just human genes, if it also refers to naturally occurring genes, because it does say within all the documentation I've read about this so far that synthetically created genetic material can be patented. But
that's what I'm saying. What's synthetically created, that's good shit. Like mixing shit is probably considered
synthetic. There's another side to this coin though, because if it's not just human genetic material that we're talking about here, and it's also any genetic material found in nature, then that opens up all kinds of avenues for GMO companies like Monsanto to develop all kinds of crazy shit, and that's something that a lot of people aren't happy about at the moment. So I'm really curious.
Well, I mean, wait, I don't understand the downside that you're saying. So like,
What I'm saying is I'm interested in finding out whether this particular ruling is just about human genetic material only. The article
or whether or not it goes further.
The precedent's been set that because it occurs in nature and people have it, that it's a thing. Monsanto has messed with genes. They GMO stuff is
right.
It's plasmid created in order to change the genetic structure of the device, the quote unquote product, so that when it grows in a separate way. That stuff is probably going to remain protected, and that's probably why the Supreme Court wasn't too worried about making this something. It works when it comes to civil liberties. This decision works when it comes to civil liberties. It works when it comes to conservatives
about like the body, God, and all that stuff. And it works in terms of our society. Where it wouldn't work is if Monsanto had figured out a way to take X gene over here or manipulate X gene, put it in there, and you know, associate that with wheat so that wheat grows without seeds or something like that. That would be a problem. Business would not approve. There'd be, you know, there'd be enough pressure to like have a constitutional amendment that would like overturn this kind of crap. That's not really going to happen. But I do think that, for instance, if you find a gene in a frog, just that gene in a frog, as it actually occurs, will remain open source, so to speak. It's the crossing of genes, the manipulation of genes, the creation of whole new genes that make our skin green because we live on Mars now or something. That's the kind of thing that will remain protected based on what I've read about this decision so far.
Right.
So Monsanto is going to be in protection for some time.
Oh, right. Yeah, I'm just saying I wonder what the long-term ramifications are in terms of the impact that they have on you know, the small farmers in the country, if you will, because there's all kinds of issues associated with that. But I'm opening up a completely different can of worms there, and if we start going down that track, we'll never get to PRISM. So
I will say this, though. There's room here for Gattaca-like work to do really, really quite well. Mm-hmm. So you've got this thing where you're looking at, you know, a guy and let's say another guy, and you're like, okay, each of you have an X chromosome that made you, and each of you have a Y chromosome that made you. We'll take the X from this guy and the Y from that guy, and we'll mess around with it, and then we'll mess with these gene with their problems, obviously. We can't just, like, throw them together. So we're going to mess with these genes here, here, and here to make your like, baby work. That's going to be a thing. Or, like, just two, like, heterosexual people, we're going to choose this gene and that gene from you, and you, and we're going to combine them all to make it work so you can have the best kid that you could possibly have. All that stuff is going to probably be protected because it's going to fall under process, much like software patents.
Or it might get Lex Luthor to make a more effective nuclear man.
Right, which is important because you need that nuclear man because Superman is just too super. It's really annoying. I can't read his damn shit. Super smart, super fast. What the hell? Where's this challenge? What, Lois Lane?
All right, and on that note, let's take a moment to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com, the world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the book I'd like to recommend this week is called The Shadow Factory, The Ultra-Secret NSA, From 9/11 to the Eavesdropping on America by James Bamford. And really, what more appropriate book could I pick this week than that? In The Shadow Factory, James Bamford, the foremost expert on the National Security Agency, charts its transformation since 9/11 as the legendary codebreakers turn their ears away from outside enemies such as the Soviet Union and inward to enemies whose communications increasingly crisscross America. Fast-paced and riveting, The Shadow Factory is about a world unseen by Americans without the highest security clearances, but is a world in which even their most intimate whispers may no longer be private. So to download that free audiobook, all you have to do is go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook and the 30-day trial to check out their service. Even if you don't like the Audible service, you get to keep the Shadow Factory for free afterwards. Just cancel your account and the Shadow Factory is yours. And going to that site, audibletrial.com/thedrilldown, helps us out here on the show. So please do that if you're not already an Audible subscriber. We're going to take a little break here and listen to some music. And when we return, what do we do when the agencies tasked with keeping us secure from threat are a threat themselves? Take a listen to this and come on back.
I awake to find no peace of mind. I said, how do you live as a fugitive down here where I cannot see so clear? I said, what do I know? Show me the right way to go. And the spies came out of the water. But you're feeling so bad, 'cause you know. And the spies hide out in every corner. But you can't touch them, no. Stay on.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Duane DeFreitas, Christopher Brenor, and Greg Davies. And before we get into our discussion of NSA eavesdropping and Prism, it's important for context to break down the chronology of events, and please stop me if I've skipped something. 2 weeks ago, The Guardian's Glenn Greenwald reported that the National Security Agency is collecting the telephone records of millions of customers of Verizon under a top-secret court order issued in April. The order requires Verizon on an ongoing daily basis to give the NSA information on all telephone calls in its systems, both within the U.S. and between the U.S. and other countries. The document shows for the first time that under the Obama administration, the communication records of millions of U.S. citizens are being collected indiscriminately and in bulk, regardless of whether they are suspected of any wrongdoing. At the same time, the Washington Post's Barton Gellman and Laura Poitras reported that the NSA and FBI are tapping directly into the central servers of 9 leading U.S. internet companies, including Microsoft, Yahoo, Google, Facebook, and Apple, extracting audio and video chats, photographs, emails, documents, and connection logs that enable analysts to track foreign targets through a program codenamed Prism. The individual source responsible for both reports, one of the most significant leaks in U.S. political history, is Edward Snowden, a 29-year-old former technical assistant for the CIA and current employee of defense contractor Booz Allen Hamilton. Snowden has been working at the National Security Agency for the last 4 years as an employee of various outside contractors. Following these reports, most of the major data companies scrambled to save face with their consumers, issuing statements either flat-out denying involvement or hedging the level of their involvement to, quote, reviewing each request carefully and then only providing the information required by law. Since then, Google, Microsoft, and Facebook have all asked the U.S. government for permission to include data requests made under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, FISA, requests that are currently so secret that they're not even allowed to acknowledge if they've received any. Bloomberg has since reported that thousands of technology, finance, and manufacturing companies are working closely with the U.S. National Security agencies, providing sensitive information in return, receiving benefits that include access to classified intelligence. Greg, let's kick off this discussion with you. Have a little something that you wanted to play.
I got a clip here, and I'm not going to proceed it with any prejudicial remarks or anything. It's a very short clip. It's under a minute. Excuse me. And I'm just going to play it. It's somebody commenting on the actions of the U.S. government. And then the voice will sound familiar to you guys. And it will also sound familiar to a lot of the Drill Down audience. If not all of them, then a lot of them. I'll make the revelations after the clip. So this is the clip. Here we go.
There's a lot more going on that we don't know about, that they're keeping secret, that many people would think is actually against the law. The government has declared whole classes of information, including the locations of everyone in America, as detected by their cell phones, which report back to the cell phone companies where they are, that the government is now sweeping all of that information together without any warrant. They're spying on where everyone is all the time without getting a court to sign off on it. That's a huge shift and very scary.
Okay, that was an interview conducted last July in 2012 on Russia Today, and the person speaking, Aaron Swartz.
Mm.
So it raises a lot of questions about how much Aaron Swartz actually knew about this stuff, and it certainly sounds like he knew a lot about what was going on with the NSA. And the NSA stuff, it isn't exactly secret. A lot of us have known that this has been going on for over a decade now. And,
I mean, it was previewed on 24.
Well, it was every it's everyone everyone's really kind of who's been on the tech punchline have known about this for a long time. The Prism releases are really the first time we've had some real official evidence about it. Let's not forget there's been other NSA whistleblowers over the last 10 years as well. And but Aaron Swartz is obviously someone who was very well connected about with this. He was very vocal about this stuff, and it certainly raises questions about whether it was just the court case that he was facing that led to his untimely death.
Oh, that's an interesting theory. Now, President Obama responded to these reports by saying that Congress not only knew about the NSA's action, but overwhelmingly approved the programs. And saying that our duly elected representatives have been consistently informed on exactly what we're doing. So, I mean, it sounds like that he's sort of like trying to shift the burden of the blame off of him and onto his predecessor.
Well, of course it does. And so it should, because if you remember back to 2007 when he was running for president, as candidate Obama running for president of the United States, he unequivocally said in many speeches that it was time to stop the warrantless wiretapping and all of that stuff. He said this is documented everywhere in countless speeches. So essentially,
but it's not wiretapping. That's the big difference. Like, I think there's we need to lay out what the difference is here. Like, I'm not. You know, I've got my own issues with the president, but I'm gonna say that. Here, I don't feel like there is a specific lie or anything that's like he's not gone back against his word or anything. Wiretapping is when you listen to people's conversations. It's not what's happening. That's like at the very least, we should lay out what PRISM is in terms of what we know about it, what's been confirmed about it. And that is well, that the data around your conversations and your text messages or your iMessages or whatever has been kept by the NSA so they can then look at correlating things. And that data is looked at. When I say that data, I mean who's been called, when they've been called, where those calls came from.
Metadata.
That's what's held. Yeah. We call it metadata, but that's what it really is. It's kind of like how you have an MP3 and you know the song title, you know, or a file rather on your computer. You know the song title, who wrote it or who was responsible for it, when you downloaded it, all that stuff. That's mostly what they're looking at. It's unclear what else they have, no doubt, but that's we're not talking about people like having a computer listen to everything that you say when you're on the phone or read everything that you've done when you're on your email or whatever. Not yet, at least.
I don't
really, you had something you were going to say on that?
I don't have any evidence of that. I don't believe that for a minute. But what I will say is that the buzzword metadata, the official position of the NSA over the last couple of weeks, and the government, mind you, has been that the metadata that they've pulled from the phone conversations only includes numbers. Now, a NSA whistleblower, Thomas Drake, has already been on record to say that that's absolute rubbish because the key that is used for the database searching is the names of the individuals, not the phone numbers. So the names are the big issue. And the moment you assign the name of a US citizen to this metadata in an active search in these databases, that's when you need a warrant. That's where you're crossing the line on the Fourth Amendment. And that's what a lot of people have a huge issue with.
Yeah, but we don't have any evidence. We don't have any evidence about that is the only problem I have with that. Like, I want – like, the thing about Snowden, that was so – and let's get into a little bit about, like – let's go into the metadata of what's happened with PRISM. Snowden is this gentleman who's shown up and he said, hey, look, I am aware of this stuff happening. And I have data that represents that this stuff's happening. I have figured out how this stuff's happening, and I'm going to explain to you how this stuff's happening. This is very different from the Manning guy who said, hey, look, I have some stuff I'm going to put on WikiLeaks. This guy is deliberate. He's focused, obviously has an agenda, and he's in part focused on like, you know, maintaining his own freedom. And in doing that, he's been hanging out with this kind of idea that he's going to release data in a timely manner because he wants to expose it and get the most amount of media coverage possible. And he's done that by releasing data that sources can verify that lead to actual stories. And some of this other stuff about, oh yeah, I know that the government can read all your stuff, we've heard that for years, and it may be true, it may not be true, but Snowden's important because he's released actual data that the government itself has been like, yeah, he managed to get his hands on that. Or Booz Allen has been like, oh, we're in trouble because he got his hands on that and he ran away with it. And that's important.
Let's not forget,
it's straight up important. We need data before we can actually talk about it from a press perspective.
Let's not also forget that Booz Allen is also owned by, in part, they've got a majority shareholder stake, by the Carlyle Group.
Mm-hmm.
which is getting absolutely no coverage in the media at all. I mean, there's a little bit, but it's
well, that's why you incorporate under a group name. That's why you have a group, so that when your subsidiaries screw up, it's them and not you.
So, but anyway, the interesting thing about this whole thing is that I believe that this has been going on for a long time. Now we've finally got some solid evidence that it has, that it is. Dwayne, you seem a little bit skeptical about the data that comes out, and I'll respect you for that, and I'll disagree with you on that. I believe this has been going on for quite some time, and advocates, you know, of civil liberties and privacy have been screaming this for a very long time, including people like Aaron Swartz, and I'm with them, I'm afraid. I think that this is...
I'm not against them. I just need to see data.
CNET has put out an article the other day that got very limited coverage on the mainstream media, mind you. I believe that they were the only link that I saw.
See, that's like mainstream media?
In that the NSA admitted that they were, you know, getting this information without warrants.
We've got it linked in our show notes.
That was from Representative Gerald Nadler of New York, disclosed on Thursday that during a secret briefing to members of Congress, he was told that the contents of a phone call could be accessed, quote, simply based on an analyst deciding that. He did apparently retract that statement later. See, here's what I want to.
Okay, and if you know anything, let's go on here. If you know anything about Jerry Nadler, who is well known for making sure he got some cookies during the Clinton trial rather than actually like voting about the impeachment. He's a good guy. I've met him, but he's not the best source in the Congress for this kind of information because he's not sitting on these committees.
I agree. I think that the thing that comes up to me more about this is I think we need to have this sort of debate about what is happening and what is not happening. And I think most of us, at least in the tech world, suspected that something like this was happening. I think the thing that bothers me most about this is the secrecy around these programs that may even still having this sort of discussion almost impossible to have. Like, you're right, Dwayne, we don't know anything. At the same time, what we do know is that in several cases where we were explicitly told that, you know, all these are specific and targeted, pulling on people, and then we find out that, you know, the Verizon thing, which also under the same law was supposed to be specific and targeted, is pulling at everyone. Those things combined together make a very worrying picture that, you know, yeah, maybe Google is only giving data based on warrants that are coming in and they're reviewing everyone. But we also know from the Verizon one that warrants can mean everyone that uses your system. Like, it's the fact that it's entirely hidden and entirely unknown that makes this such a problem. Like, I don't even think that it's necessarily a problem. Like, in some way, shape, or form, the government might want to look into that data. Maybe that's a reasonable position. I don't know. I don't think that way, but I think we need to have that debate. But we can't if we don't even know what's going on. That's what bothers me the most about this.
Yeah, I mean, I don't disagree with you, and I'm not trying to discount what Greg is saying. I think that there is totally reason to believe that the government has been, you know, scanning. Like, I try to conceive of what kind of hardware this would take. And that kind of blows my mind a little bit to listen to everyone's conversation, whatever. I mean, I made the 24 joke, but the idea that chatter exists. What I will say is that the fact that the government wants to do this doesn't bother me as much as the fact that the government doesn't want to say it. Like, when it comes to, you know, plans for how we're going to like invade and like destroy the Taliban in Afghanistan, fine. When it comes to the idea that the government's listening to all your stuff, that has to be relatively transparent. Because if it's not, that's where tyranny has harmed, you know, almost irrevocably one of the bastions of freedom in this world. So
the problem situation.
Hold that thought for just a second. Let me just add Tosin to the conversation.
Sure.
Tosin, how you doing?
Hi, doing pretty well yourselves.
We're doing great. We're just jumping in the middle of the Prism conversation, the Prism debate. Now, I'm sorry, Greg, go ahead, finish your thought there.
I was just going to say the problem with this isn't the fact that they've been doing it or that these programs are in place. The problem that is with these established programs is that it sets a dangerous precedent. A lot of Obama supporters will say, well, he's not going to be doing anything wrong about it because, you know, we're going to go after the terrorists or whatever the case may be. And a lot of the Bush supporters would have said the same thing under his administration as well. The problem is that opening this kind of stuff up to make it okay now is makes a lot of things uncertain because we don't know who the next dude is and what he's going to do with the program, or the following person, or the following person after that. And that's what makes these elements of legislation such as FISA and the Patriot Act extremely dangerous, because it opens up potential for all kinds of abuse.
Yeah, I mean, the executive branch has never given up power easily. They've always been forced to by the Supreme Court or some Congress or whatever. So I would say the problem here is the executive branch saying, well, it's power. And the fact is, I'm, you know, part of the most exclusive club of people in the world. And no one knows how hard this job is. We need every tool in the box we can have, all that stuff. I don't disagree with you there. Who's the next person going to be? Is it going to be like a Clinton type person who could be, you know, as even handed as Obama, or could it be a Clinton type person who's as hardcore as Bush, or could it be someone completely different? We don't know. But I will say that if the government's going to do this, the problem with PRISM is that it's legal. That's the thing we have to deal with. It's legal. It is completely and utterly legal. And the issue that we have to have, to Chris's point, is we have to have a rabble-rousing discussion in order to make it so that this kind of action is illegal. So, I mean, and on some level, there's spilt milk here. But we have to go ahead and, you know, fire the legislators who are in there that have said this is okay and have hidden it from us, and hire the legislators that can get in there and change it around and be like, hey, look, this is not okay. You don't need to spy on people to figure stuff out. Or maybe it's an easy way to do it, but guess what? Life is hard. Figure out a different way.
I think this whole situation is totally unacceptable. I mean, it didn't find the Sun Arab brothers with the Boston bombing. So why is this all this money being wasted on these resources? Unacceptable.
That's not a question I can answer, but what I can say is that
I'm just saying, I'm putting it out there, though. It's just, you know, the Sonara brothers are the alleged perpetrators of the Boston bombing. You know, if this stuff is all in place, why weren't they stopped beforehand? When the NSA came out, was it today? And they said something like they've stopped 50 terrorist attacks around the world because of this. Well, okay. What about the ones that were stopped, you know, in the United States? If charges were filed, then they've got to be public record, right? Right? That's got to be the case. So, you know, that stuff, I mean, should you prove
it? Well, the thing is, they're never, if they can help it, I mean, if I'm the NSA and I'm going to talk about the efficacy of this program, I'm not going to tell you which attacks in the United States this foiled. Why? Because if you're a person who's interested, you can deconstruct and understand those attacks because there's so much public record on them. And you can figure out where I picked it up, where I figured it out. And in the future, that's an amount of knowledge you can use to say, oh, I can get around it by not making these mistakes. So if I'm the NSA, I'm not going to say that at first glance. To expect that the NSA or anybody who has a vested interest in this program in order to make their job easier would give open and fluent information about it would be folly. But
no, that's true. But they've got there's an element of accountability here. I mean, you know, this is being funded by taxpayers essentially, and you know they should be accountable to the people for that. And if people are being monitored unconstitutionally, then you know that needs to be addressed. And if they have had some successes with this,
but the problem is it's not unconstitutionally. Well, unless there's a Supreme Court challenge to it, because the problem isn't that this is not the problem with the scandal. From an outrage perspective, is it a scandal? Absolutely. Is it a question of misconduct? That's too gray, because this PRISM thing was taken care of under a system of law that allowed it. Not unlike how. Oh, man, I'm about to say this is going to be crazy. not unlike how there was a system of law that allowed a certain person to become both the, you know, to become the Chancellor of Germany in the 1930s.
Oh, you went there.
I did. It was kind of crazy.
Godwin's
right?
Law,
crazy.
Going home.
Right. Okay. What I'm saying is the government, when that guy took over the government in his area,
he didn't do anything illegal. Like, after he got in there, he went, or no, I'm sorry, just before he got in there, the illegal part was killing all those people, so the Night of Long Knives happened. Yeah, that's terrible. But what I'm saying is, right now, when you look at Prism, and this is the problem, it's, there's no one has, they've, the asses have been covered, so there hasn't been any misconduct, right? Like, there had, like, the Patriot Act allowed for the secret court to be made. The secret court passed these, like, allowed these things to happen. Laws were passed outside of everything. This is all legal. And the problem isn't that Prism happened. The problem is that this stuff could be allowed to be legal. And that's why the Chris point of, like, we have to, like, have this debate and have people angry and have, like, protests. We have to more than have protests. We have to fire legislators that allow this to happen. And there are plenty of legislators that have done great things that I'm behind, but some of them have done this thing. And just like a celebrity who murders somebody who has to go to jail for it, I think that the, some of the legislators that I actually like that were behind this need to be put down in terms of their careers. That's the problem. Well, this is unfortunately legal. That's the big problem.
That's most of the politicians. I mean, if you look at the news, like last week when they started the hearings on Friday, less than half of senators and congressmen and women showed up to the hearings. They all went home for the weekend, and their reason was Father's Day.
A lot of the defenders of PRISM and the NSA's eavesdropping say that people shouldn't have to worry about their privacy being invaded if they have nothing to hide.
Well, that old chestnut.
That old chestnut, yes.
Can we just all agree that the idea that, like, if you have nothing to hide, don't worry about it,
yeah.
is specious? The fact is, a citizen of this country should never have to, a citizen of the free world, a citizen, a person in our human rights, you know, our situation believes that no one should ever have to worry about whether or not what they're doing, that is obviously not a clear violation of the law, is something that they have to worry about. We're not in a position where we're like Max Weber living under the Protestant ethic. We're not in a position where we're living in Salem, Massachusetts, where the chosen people simply don't act like that. So you don't have to worry. If you're chosen, you'll behave nicely. We're human beings that live in a society that has
Salem,
laws.
The Massachusetts Salem. The Salem thing, I think, is actually a really good example for, I think, the way that most people misinterpret the significance of nothing to hide.
Yeah.
Because what the nothing to hide, I mean, it sort of has a similar problem to my criticism of Facebook, in the sense that there's this sense that, like, anything you say should be able to be open, which sort of ends up having this sort of suburbanization of society, like this sort of like Stepford Wives type world where, oh yeah, everyone's open, but it enforces this sort of centering of the norm without – and anyone who's on the fringe or anyone who's outside of that are the people who are going to be cut off from that. And so most people think, oh, well, I'm in the norm and everyone I know is in the norm, so why would I have anything to hide? And they forget about, you know, the people – that, you know, for them might be heroes, are they going to be the people who the opposite pole is going to be suspicious of? I mean, for example, you know, if you're on, you know, the left of the U.S., like, you might look up a little bit to, you know, anti-nuclear activists or, you know, Greenpeace type people. Those are the people who are going to be put under suspicion on this. If you're more on the right, like, take missionaries going to third world countries trying to do, you know, religious exercises, definitely could look very sketchy, you know, communicating, you know, across the board.
Sure.
It's those people that are the edge and sort of the parts of our society that move it forward, almost, whatever your political affiliations are, that are the people that have the most to lose from this, and the most, and those people are the ones that we have the most to lose from if they find it, you know, impossible to travel because of this. They find it impossible to, you know, call or do their jobs because of this.
The argument that I've seen most quoted is that we may not be doing anything illegal, but if we are doing a web search for stage 4 cancer and also doing a web search for, medical equipment that an insurance company could be looking at that web search and then determine that we are looking for ourselves and cancel our insurance.
Well, let's even look at something even simpler in today's term.
Andy, yeah, more just, benign, yeah.
Andy, just pretend for a minute that you're one of these people that say, oh, I don't care, I got nothing to hide. Say that to me. Tell me that you got nothing to hide.
I got nothing to hide.
What's your password? You got a credit card number there. I can have mine. That's my counter argument to a lot of the people that say I've got nothing to hide.
The fundamental privacy, and I think it's a little bit of a shame that a guy who wasn't born here had to like lay that out for us. It's the fundamental. Have stuff. Your property isn't just, you know, your life, liberty, property. Your property isn't just what you own. It's how you access it. It's what's in your mind. It's what's in your thinking and feeling. And just like we passed laws long ago to say that your library records are private to you and your video rentals are private to you, we cannot now pass laws that say that your communications with other people are not private to you, right? Now, granted, if you look back at those old paradigms that this country is leaning on, like, well, you know, we can tell that you sent a letter to somebody else because you put your return address on it. Therefore, we can tell that you sent an email to somebody because whatever, but we're not going to read your letter. We're not going to read your email. That seems benign, except for the fact that we communicate a hell of a lot more over email than we ever have over letters in the last 100 years or last 50 years.
Well, see, that's what a lot of people are forgetting. Like, when I moved over here, I went out of my way to learn a lot about American politics and the way things were founded and the Constitution and things like that. And the whole purpose of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights being set up the way it is was to stop further and future abuses.
Right, and, exactly. You know, we're trying to keep, you know, queen and country out of our shit.
It's a guideline, essentially, that should be followed. And, you know, if you look at what has been laid out here as to what the NSA have been doing or what they're accused of being doing, and I believe they are doing it because Snowden is only the most recent out of a number of NSA whistleblowers. When you look at what's going on here, there's clear violation of the Fourth Amendment. And yeah, it doesn't really, you know, a lot of people say, well, you know, we've got to protect the country and everything. And okay, but there's ways that this can be done without violating civil liberties. And the problem that we should be looking at here is not what's going on now, it's what's the next guy going to do with this.
Right.
If the legal ramifications are set up the way they are now, you know, and I've got to say, you know, I used to be fairly left of center when it came to politics, and I was pretty excited when Obama came into office. You know, we've still got Guantanamo Bay open. We've got this rubbish going on still that's been continued since the Bush regime. And of course, there's also the dronings as well of like American citizens overseas as well, which is just absolutely unacceptable. So, you know,
that just sounds like you're still left of center. If there is a center to begin with.
Where are people going to draw the line? I mean, when are people going to... I mean, because you sort of saw some of these arguments pop up a little bit with the Occupy Wall Street movement, even though that kind of popped up out of a completely different argument. But it was just so flaccid the way they were doing it. You know, this whole thing needs to come to a boiling point, to a breaking point, to a new movement, to a new protest movement, if you will, about civil liberties, in which you're not doing mic check, but instead you're lifting the middle finger and saying to the government, fuck you, I won't do what you tell me.
Yeah, it's actually really
interesting. Rage Against the Machine reference there.
It's really interesting how in every sort of area, people are trying to redefine what personal property is, not only the government, but we see, I think the same thing can be described of in, I guess, one of your earlier conversations about, you know, Microsoft and DRM and, you know, even with the music industry, it's really the notion of what we own as individuals seem to get smaller and smaller, even though our technology keeps expanding. And I wonder if at a point, you know, will the people say enough is enough, or will they continue to really secede?
We'll continue to cede personal freedom for convenience until the point where we're all living in Elysium. That's a growing trend. The trend is to say, I get it, but this is just so much more convenient, so I'm okay with it. That's the trend. That's what the data tells us. So
You know what? Snowden did this whole thing wrong, and I talked about this on the most recent Blendover as well. We're doing ongoing coverage of this on our podcast, and Snowden did this all wrong. I think what he should have done was, instead of putting all this information out, he should have collected as many phone calls between senators and congressmen and the president and all this seedy, scandalous shit and put it out for everyone to see. And I guarantee you the laws would have changed overnight.
You got to I agree. That's actually right along the lines of this, what I was going to bring up. I think that the problem that the geek community is having on this is somewhat similar. Did you read the article? I can't remember. I think it was the Atlantic or the New Yorker that had an article, sort of really in-depth article about why the marriage equality movement went from basically no successes up until 2008, even including the 2008 sort of Democratic sweep, to an extremely successful 2012 election cycle. And the sort of gist of that article was that rather than making the argument about, abstract concepts like human rights, mm-hmm. they made it personalized stories about specific people that, wanted to get married but couldn't because of, laws. And when they did that, it suddenly became a dramatically different issue. And I think that that's some of the problem that we're going to run into for those of us who care about civil liberties as the abstract issues that, for people who aren't as involved in, the tech world, the data world, whatever, like that narrative is just not going to connect with them. I really do think that people do care about privacy and rights. They don't care about it though on an abstract level. They care about it on a personal level because they just don't have the interest or the time. They're doing other things.
I'm sorry, I keep cutting into people here, but
it's okay. I tend to ramble towards the end of my thoughts.
There's another aspect to what you're talking about there, and we all five of us on this show deal with it on a daily basis, and especially with a podcast like The Drill Down, is that there's a lot of techno babble involved in this. There's a lot of jargon, before we started recording the show, I told you guys I work in tech support. Part of my job is translating the geek speak to people that don't really understand it. And there's a ton of people out there, even in this country, that still are somewhat distant from full comprehension of, the technical nature of this surveillance and how extensive it is. So there's going to be a lot of people that look at this kind of thing and say, this is, I don't understand it. And so you're right in a sense that someone needs to solidify the issue into one or two, A or B, black or white, very much like a lot of the Second Amendment debates that have been going on since Sandy Hook. You've got, pretty much the country split down the center with a lot of people pushing for gun rights and another group to put, you can't take my guns away kind of attitude. And, that's a very solid concept that people can grasp, whereas this, it's very icky, gooey, mucous membrane-y.
We're going to take a little break here and listen to some music, and when we return, we're going to continue our discussion on NSA eavesdropping and PRISM. So take a listen to this, and come on back. Swatching.
I work from 9 to 5. Hey, hell, I pay the price. All I want is to be left alone.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom. I'm Andy Cercini. I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas, Christopher Brenor, Tosin Anafuaken, and guest Greg Davies. And we're discussing the NSA eavesdropping slash Prism slash Edward Snowden issue. Another thing I wanted to mention that we hadn't mentioned yet is that Edward Snowden has been continuing to release more documents, more revelations since his refuge in Hong Kong. In an exclusive interview, he noted that the U.S. government has been hacking into computers in Hong Kong and on the China mainland for years. And this is... this actually is no surprise to me, but it's interesting in relation to
the PR machine that's been saying about how China has been nefariously hacking into the United States computers for so long.
Exactly. A little bit of it's not like we're completely innocent here.
Yeah, and let's just talk about this Hong Kong part. Like, I think there was a lot of speculation why Hong Kong. It's not Spain. There's not any non-extradition treaty. There's no treaties at all. Hong Kong is not a fan of people who whistleblow. They like control over their data. Hong Kong might be a dangerous place for a man like Snowden to go. But if you think about Hong Kong and mainland China's motivations, Snowden is somewhat of a hero for showing the American hypocrisy that they've been claiming for however long they've been claiming it. It helped them politically in terms of propaganda and so on and so forth. Hong Kong is an English-speaking part of China. And while I don't think he's got legal protection there, I think he has sentiment protection there that pretty much makes it so that the United States will have to give over a big chunk of something in order to extradite Snowden from that area. And then there's the idea that we have to worry about our sentiment when he comes back. Should Snowden come back? I mean, not a lot of people have lifted a finger for Mr. Manning, who did some of his own whistleblowing. But I think Snowden has worked from a PR perspective in a way that comes across as hyper-intelligent and quite focused in his needs and means. Also, coming from Booz Allen Hamilton, that's a level of prestige that you don't get by being a person working in the Army. Booz Allen is some place that actually many Amherst grads are excited to go to if they can land a job. So I think he's held a certain level of grace under pressure and elitism that has kept him, coming across as a person who makes deliberate and intelligent decisions, and that's only helped him in this endeavor.
Yeah, if you look at the timing of each of his releases, it's been amazing how much I think each specific release has been timed. The release about the U.S.'s cyber war policy was released just the day before Obama was going to meet with the new leader of China. There was one last week that was released about how the British Secret Service, I don't remember what their name is, had basically wiretapped all of the delegates at the last G20 summit, and that was released like the day or so before the G8 summit in Britain. Mm-hmm. I mean, he clearly knows what he's doing from a PR perspective on this, and that, I must say, it's very interesting.
The question is how long he will be able to maintain his value by releasing this kind of information. That's the big question.
Yeah. But, I'm really interested about this character, Edward Snowden, anyway. And I know some people have kind of tracked down his relatives and stuff like that. But, the name doesn't even sound right. It sounds like a conglomeration of characters from Game of Thrones. who's to say, this guy might be more smart than we expect. He might not even be the guy that we've seen on video. That could just be like an actor fronting for the real guy doing the leaks.
I have no doubt that Edward Snowden is more intelligent than the vast majority of people following him expect.
Yeah.
Like, he's played every move relatively properly. The only time will tell.
Yeah.
But he's also, worked in such a way. I mean, 50 years ago, he would have been not a whistleblower, as we call him now, but a Soviet spy, double agent, that blew the whistle on our biggest secrets. So society has changed in a way to recognize the value that he's bringing to us and being able to have these discussions. If you're going to whistleblow, read from Snowden's book and not Manning's book. And it's clear that Snowden read from Manning's book and made some deliberate decisions to behave otherwise.
Well, the reason Snowden did what he did wasn't really because of what happened to Manning. what the way he did what he did was because of what happened with William Benny and Thomas Drake from the NSA. Now, you know, the NSA have been, you know, in the press that they've been doing over the last week have said, you know, he could have done this through the proper channels where, you know, we have whistleblowing thing channels in effect. These guys, Benny and Drake and all the other guys that have done whistleblowing, went through those channels and they threw the book at them. They indicted them. They took them to court under the Espionage Act.
Edward Snowden is not he's not protected from suffering that same fate. He's just that's the thing. He's smart enough not to follow those rules because following those rules is not going to help you. Despite the fact that whistleblower legislation was passed, there's just too much entrenched interest in getting at you domestically. So he thought it out and he left.
Yeah.
I don't even believe he's in Hong Kong still. I think he's gone. I think he's elsewhere. I don't even believe he's there. I think he's in another location in the world somewhere.
Yeah, it's also really easy for him to, like, you know, if you're that part of the world is a place that's easy to disappear in. Southeast Asia, Macau, Singapore, wherever. Well, not Singapore because it's too friendly to the U.S., but those places are places that is, like, you know, for a Caucasian, it's a little harder, but you can go to a place where there is no contact or limited contact or whatever.
Yeah. One thing that I wanted to bring up on this, which is a little bit different, but it sort of kind of amazes me about this whole thing. So this particular thing happened because Snowden chose to whistleblow on this data. One thing that kind of bothers me just about the whole sort of thing on this is just like for all the money that apparently has been spent on this, the level of systematic protection of the data just seems to be laughable in terms of like the fact that a single person working for a contractor can get such access to this. I mean, like
at my let me stop you there. One, it's not a contractor working for a company. It's a guy working for Booz Allen Hamilton. That's not just a company, that's an institution. People who work there work really hard to get there, and they believe in what they do there, and they maintain the same kind of confidentiality that you'd have at a law firm, wherever. Two, the other people looking at this data are likely, you know, United States government oath-taking personnel. So what's surprising isn't that that it's laughable security and protection. Fine, you can throw all the security you want at it. What's surprising is how easily a secret is kept in a place where people are motivated properly. Snowden clearly did not have his incentives aligned with those people who were paying him or the work he was doing, which is why he's doing what he's doing. But I think it's important to understand that this isn't just some guy working for just some company. He's an outlier of the culture. The culture is to say, I'm not going to let this out because the repercussions or because I believe in my country or because I'm getting paid too much or because of whatever.
But that's my point, is that, like, I mean, you're making arguments based on assuming that a rational actor chooses to release the data. It doesn't help situations where somebody gains access who shouldn't. It doesn't help situations where somebody decides to kidnap a worker who works there and hold them hostage for the information they have. I mean, like, this is one of the reasons why security systems exist, is because even when you trust everybody involved in it, you don't necessarily trust what they can do, because we realize that there's a lot more, you know, that's possible than just simply people choosing to turn turncoat.
There's another perspective to this that needs to be addressed as well, and that is that this case of Snowden taking the data and releasing it to the public is by definition what's called an insider threat. If you look at corporations and their system administrators, which is what Snowden was, he was a sysadmin, there's the big buzzword about insider threats at the moment is that if somebody is fired from a company, they're a sysadmin, then there's a concern that they may use the confidential and sensitive data that they have access to against the company.
The idea here is that I think one of the reasons why it's not as simple as saying, oh my God, the security is so lax, is because these people are highly motivated through whatever means that whatever intangible means they are that has led this culture to exist in this way.
And also, to NSA's credit, they recently reported that they're going to be instituting a two-person rule in the future So that not only does there have to be an outside contractor to access materials like this, but somebody directly on the inside of the National Security Agency as well, and the two of them would have to be colluding together in order to get documents like this out in the future.
Right, and that's all I mean is that when you look at like a Sony data breach, you look at like an NSA data breach like this from an outside contractor, from, you know, Booz Allen or wherever, it's just it's not as simple as saying, oh man, Sony was dumb, how come they didn't encrypt it? It's just a bigger deal than that. This is a systemic problem for the NSA. And how they approach that, yes, you can have dual whatever, but, you know, there's always a price for somebody. And who knows if Snowden had a price. He could have been paid by the government of China. He could have a deal there. That wouldn't surprise any of us, would it, really?
No, not really.
Can we talk a little bit about the long-term political ramifications of this for a second?
There are none.
Because I just wanted to point out that this case in particular reminds me so much of what a 21st century version of Watergate would look like. You know, it's very similar. It has very similar strands to it. And there's been a few scandals in the Obama administration so far that haven't taken off, such as, you know, the Fast and Furious, you know, the whole Benghazi thing. Now that this has come out, it seems so huge and full of depth and a massive problem. And I have often thought to myself since all this information came out whether his administration is actually going to be able to survive this scandal. This is a pretty huge deal.
You think that you're saying that he might become impeached and have to leave office in disgrace?
I'm not proposing anything of the sort. But what I'm saying is that I'm finding a lot of parallels with what the Nixon administration went through with the Watergate.
You think that Obama has behaved so poorly that he'll have to resign from the country and leave Joe Biden in charge?
Again, I'm not proposing anything. I'm just noticing a lot of parallels.
I'm not seeing any parallels at all. There was an administration private conspiracy to break into a place and steal records, whereas this is and that was illegal. The problem again with this is that it's completely legal. It was everyone who runs the country, the government, the government, which is by nature a group of people who are ungoverned, in at least two branches of it, were behind three branches. There was a court system part of it, there was a legislative part of it, and there was an executive part of it. Two executives, really, Bush and then Obama. And everyone's complicit. So the ramifications are not going to attack his administration. It's not his administration's fault. The only person who's going to get sacked is the NSA guy for screwing that up.
He might be.
Yeah, but Obama is going to walk away scot clear from this. Yes. Is it embarrassing? Sure. Was it legal? They have all the stuff to lay in front of the press and be like, dudes, you guys may not have known about it, but that's the way the government works, and there's nothing to be said about it. With Nixon, he's like, oh, my bad. I got caught with my hand in the cookie jar, plus I have all these tapes of me being an asshole. There's a big difference.
Didn't Obama actually pretty early on come out and say that, you know, what they were doing is legal?
Yep.
Yeah, it's legal. That's the problem.
Yep.
No, and you might say that it's not legal, but it's legal insofar as we're not in a position where the courts or anybody has been able to put a case in front of the Supreme Court and say, what up, let's turn it out. So we have years of litigation behind this. The Nixon thing was a clear violation. It was breaking and entering. It was a clear, you know, attack on law and order. This is not. This is complete order with the force of law behind it.
You're misinterpreting my intentions here, Dwayne. What I'm essentially saying is that you have with the Watergate situation that was driven by Deep Throat. An insider source that was pushed by journalists. And it was such a huge scandal that the Nixon administration just couldn't survive it. And that's where I'm kind of going with this. Now, of course, I'm not proposing that, you know, Obama had anything directly involved here. But let's say, for example, that, you know, the speculation that I'd said before that maybe Snowden has access to monitored phone calls involving politicians, you know, that could, you know, push this over the edge. And of course, that's, we're nowhere near that kind of evidence yet at all. But this is, like you said, this is going to be, there's going to be heaps of litigation for this for years to come. But the key thing here is, and you're saying that it's completely legal. The key issue here is that the previous information that had been made public is legal under FISA and the Patriot Act. But with the names of American citizens being attached to the metadata that's being sucked in by this organization, opens the question as to whether this is a violation of the Fourth Amendment and therefore illegal. So it's not completely legal, and this whole thing needs to bust wide open as far as I'm concerned.
It's also really reinvigorated a lot of the – I know the ACLU and the EFF have been spending years trying to basically prove that they have standing to sue on these. You know, they haven't even got to the point where they can even have a case. They are simply – not, you know, they haven't been able to prove that they existed. So by having an actual example, they can actually start to move forward and actually test in the real courts, not the FISA courts, whether or not this is legal or not.
There's actually, I'll dig up a link so that Andy can use it for the show notes, but there is actually at the EFF website, there is a fantastic timeline of events of surveillance of American in the United States, and that includes a lot of the information that has previously been leaked out about the NSA, but it also has some extensive details on the court cases specifically against AT&T that the EFF have been spearheading all the way, and it's actually fascinating reading, and it's well worth taking a look. So I'll dig up that link.
I just want to say one last thing on the Fourth Amendment. The metadata aspect of this circumvents the needs, the issues of the Fourth Amendment. That's the problem. That's why it's legal.
Because
until
it's
there's
specific.
An interpretation, so what happens is this metadata, this idea that he talked to him, we don't know what he said, he talked to this person. That's where you circumvent. It doesn't matter who said it or whatever. That's where you circumvent the rule of law. Vis-a-vis the Fourth Amendment. Now, do you circumvent the spirit of law? You can say that, but that's fine. But let me just finish, and I'm going to say this. Let me finish. The spirit of the Fourth Amendment is clearly broken. The letter of the Fourth Amendment is not, and that's why this remains legal until we do something. It's like the gun issue, right? Are guns killing people in terrible ways? Yes, but is there a violation of the Second Amendment happening? Not as interpreted by the Supreme Court in the last 100 years, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's going to take more than just kind of like litigating it and throwing it in front of a court's face. We're going to have to do some serious legislative work. This isn't a black and white case. It's not as simple as that. We have a system, and it's a systemic problem with the way the system deals with this kind of situation. That's why it's legal. These are smart people who figured out a way to get around the blockades in front of an easy way to solve a problem. And that's why the Fourth Amendment is not in a clear state of violation.
No, I disagree with you there. I completely disagree with you there, because if you look at the information about the Verizon stuff, for example, you're talking about thousands upon thousands, perhaps even if you look over the years, maybe millions of aspects of metadata that has been handed into the government. And, you know, once you start tracking a certain individual, metadata, you can actually make certain cases about where they are and what they're doing based on that information, you know. And you know, the information in the Fourth Amendment, also indicates, you know, and the short phrase, things to be seized. And this is information that about a person that has been seized, and the Fourth Amendment. You know,
I think it's a fine line between.
Fine line here. Let me say why. The government had this case before. These guys. No, I'm gonna put my foot down. These guys. The FBI put GPS trackers on someone's car and just chased them around without a warrant. Why? Because that car was not in a garage. Yeah. They didn't break and enter. They didn't do anything like that. And the courts upheld the fact that they can look and follow that information. And that's why it doesn't break the law. Am I in agreement with what's happening? No.
Am I happy about what's happening? No.
And Dwayne,
what I'm saying is that you can get, like, this is something that has been held up by our court system. It means that we have a systemic problem in the country,
yes,
with defining, yeah, what's legal and not legal vis-a-vis being able to track an individual situation.
And Dwayne, I'm in agreement with you here. It's a fine line between the problem is that you can make all of these inferences from the mass amount of metadata that's been provided, but the letter of the law is that it's breaking the Fourth Amendment if you have direct information, not inferences that can be made from the metadata.
And you can connect the dots, yes, exactly. You can connect these dots and you can make inferences, and maybe your inferences are wrong, maybe your inferences are right, but so long as you're not definitely doing XYZ ABC, that's the issue.
While we were going at each other, yeah, hammer and tongue there, Dwayne, I think Tyson was trying to say something.
I think what I'm more curious about is how much does the average American care about this whole thing?
That's a good question.
That's, yeah, where legislative change or any adaptation of current law will stem from. And what do you guys think?
Will this change anything? It's a good question.
That's a good question. The polls that have been going through the mainstream media seem to indicate that it's over 50% disapproving of what the NSA is doing or has been doing here.
So. Yes, but will anything happen because of that? I have a feeling that if I'm talking about it, nobody cares.
It'll be. I really think a lot of it has to do with how much additionally comes out that sort of keeps us in the news and how scandalous that is. I also think it really depends on coming up with a good narrative and way of explaining sort of what the problem is and why it's a problem and sort of that aspect. I don't know. I hate to talk about it as though it's a PR thing, but like the way that stories develop and how they get spoken about ends up dramatically affecting whether people care about it. Look at the difference between the sequester and the fiscal cliff. Literally the exact same thing, but you call one a fiscal cliff and you call the other sequester and you have a huge political difference in whether or not people care about it.
There's also another comparison that you can make, and that would be the marketing side of things that went into the advocacy against SOPA. With the blackout, mm-hmm, happened on the internet. I mean, that was huge. Another example would be the travesty that was the Kony 2012 video. You know, obviously a lot of revelations came out about that, about how much bullshit it was. But beforehand, when people were jumping on the bandwagon, the whole armchair, you know, internet slacktivist thing going on and sharing the video and all that stuff, that was a bang-up marketing job. You know, they got the word going, you know. And you look at, see, you know, what was going on with the CISPA stuff recently, and that was kind of like a fizzler compared to, you know, the advocacy that was going on with and the activism that was going on with SOPA. So it really comes down to the way, and I agree with you, it comes down to the way that it's packaged.
Let's wrap up this conversation here. Let's get some final thoughts out on the whole issue, the whole ball of wax, NSA eavesdropping, Prism, Edward Snowden, our personal privacy. Any last thoughts on this issue?
Absolutely. This is bullshit, and we need to change our shit so this can't happen.
Well, hey, man, I'm with you on that one.
Well said. Well spoken.
I'll go in a different direction. I had a friend who worked for the Navy for a while as a subcontractor, and he said that the first time he saw those slides, he knew they were legit because no one except the federal government would design slides that bad.
I mean, honestly, why isn't anyone talking about how horrible that PowerPoint slide presentation is?
It's government work.
Link that you shared with us about that?
Yeah, there's a link of some person who redid the slides, so they're actually more attractive. And I remember first seeing the data, and the first thing I thought to myself is, wow, this really burns my eyes. How could they, like, how could these tech companies ever agree to such things with such horrible slides?
They're just not PowerPoint people. They're data analysts, unfortunately.
Oh, they were using Keynote. That's why.
A couple things I want to mention here before we sign off here. There's a terrific article. I think it's a must read for anyone interested in this issue at all. It's from Chronicle.com. It's called Why Privacy Matters, Even If You Have Nothing to Hide, by Daniel J. Solove. It's a bit lengthy, but it's absolutely worth the read, and it refutes point by point that whole argument about, you know, why you shouldn't be afraid of people snooping into your stuff if you've got nothing to hide.
Yeah, I mean, that's marketing right there. The term snooping, that's a sketchy word. Snooping, sketchy, whatever. I just want to lay it out there that privacy is a concept that is relatively new in our world. It showed up during the Enlightenment. It showed up during this idea of individualism and you're not really tied to the land or tied to the state or whatever. And it's a powerful concept, and it's one that we're going. It's not as simple as the right to life or anything like that. It's one that we're going to have to. It's a moving target. It's one that we're going to have to work hard to defend and work hard to understand. And in a country where we don't educate people on civics, we don't educate people on some of the fundamentals of what makes the country great. Hell, I can look at a 14-year-old right now and ask him, you know, where the capitals of the 50 states are. He won't be able to tell me. That's
dude,
that's
I couldn't have told you at 14.
Well, I could because that was one of the tests I had. But okay. What I'm saying is that it's a shame. That's a shame that you don't know that information. And we need to have a frank and open debate about what's important in terms of what we care about as a society. We'll all say that privacy is important, but it's not important if we don't really know what privacy is. And that's something that I think, as a relatively new concept, that again is a moving target, especially in this age of digital everything, of share everything, of what does it mean to be, what permissions mean, and so on and so forth. And this idea that privacy isn't a question of hiding all your data under your mattress, but more a question of having control over who sees your data and when. I give my bank all sorts of data because I trust them. It's private data, but I trust them. We need to have this discussion in a meaningful way, and it needs to be something that is part of the national discourse indefinitely. It's not something we can talk about and have and walk away from. It's something that we need to have indefinitely, and that is at the root of the SOPA, the CISPA, the PRISM, all these things. Privacy is something that we don't quite understand as a nation yet because we haven't agreed on what it is and how valuable it is, even though it's a founding piece of what we are. And that's where we need to work.
I have two final thoughts and a selfish plug, if I may.
Sure.
The first final thought is I have a movie recommendation, and it's a German movie called The Lives of Others. And I think, Andy, you may have seen this. I think we've talked about it before. And it is about someone who worked for the surveillance state in East Germany during the 1970s and 1980s. It's an incredibly moving, emotional movie. But it also opens up some aspects to a surveillance state if the population allows this kind of stuff to continue. That's final thought number one. Final thought number two, I would personally like to go out of my way to thank the NSA for listening to the Drill Down and Blendover podcasts before they're even recorded and posted online. Thanks. We appreciate the support. And if you find episode 67 of Social Blend, I'd really appreciate it if you can email that to me. Thank you so much. And the selfish plug, you can catch me at blendover.com on the podcast weekly. We post on Monday nights. So there you go.
Terrific. One more thing that I wanted to mention before we touch base with everybody else here is that I don't want this to be all about problems and no solutions. So I'm going to post a link in our show notes called Don't Ask Your Government for Your Privacy, Take It Back. And it's basically somebody put together, collated a list of all of these alternatives to browsers, encryption.
DuckDuckGo.
Yes. These are alternative solutions that are more secure than what you're using now. So it's worth it to check it out. If you're really concerned about your privacy, it's worth it to check it out and implement some of these alternative solutions.
Yeah. So for me, I think my final thought is I'm reminded of the literature we have out there. For example, of course, George Orwell's 1984, and recommend that if you haven't read it, or even if you have and it's been a long time, you revisit that. And a quote from that book that I always recall is when he said, "The consequences of every act are included in the act itself." So dwell on that.
All right, let's go around the table here. I'm going to start with our guest, Greg Davies. Where can we find you online when you're not guesting here on the Drill Down?
You can find me anywhere if you Google CGT2099, which is my online handle, my nickname, my username, if you will. I'm on the Facebookeries and the Twitters and all that stuff. You can find me out there. Of course, we've got the TARDIS Blend podcast and the other posts that I do at geeksofdoom.com. And, of course, there's the Blendover podcast, which you can find at blendover.com. And if you do listen to it, we've got a voicemail tool there. Send us a voicemail and we'll play it on the show.
All right. Tosin, where can we find your work online when you're not here on the show?
You can find me on Twitter at twitter.com/toast4321. You can also find my random podcast with movie commentary at ircwebcast.blogspot.com.
Chris, how about yourself? Where can we find your work?
You can find all of my blogging at chrisbrenor.com. I just recently switched to Post Haven, which is the sort of resurrection of Posterous, and I've been thoroughly enjoying it. Just FYI. And then you can find me on Twitter at chrisbrenor, and on Mondays and Fridays I co-curate the Startup Digest newsletter for startup area for Bay Area events and worldwide startup related articles and videos.
And Dwayne, how about yourself?
You can always find me on Twitter.
Hold on. Let me have you start that over again, because you've got that really hot distorted mic. I don't know if you're maybe you're okay. And Dwayne, how about yourself? Where can we find your work online?
You can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/DwayneD, DwayneD. You can always find me at flavors.me/DwayneD, where you can see my entire online presence. And you can always check back here on the Jewel Down, because that's where I hang out with Andy.
All right, cool. As for myself, you can find me at MrBabyMan.com, Facebook.com, and Twitter.com. Also, Mr. Babyman. Just look me up at Mr. Babyman on Google, and you'll find all of my stuff. If you got an idea for a story you think we should be talking about, tweet us or email us at comments@thedrilldown.com. We'd love to hear from you. We really appreciate your feedback. If you got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on the site. Let the Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our wonderful audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. That is, if the NSA doesn't get to us first. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.
Dilly Gaff.
You live in the city. You mind your own business. What you see, you don't see. But some people.